here. So, he's kept his rifle. He's capable of anything. If he gets up to mischief, if he kills a German, the entire region will be held responsible, and especially the mayor. It's people like him that cause all our problems. It's my duty to denounce him. I'll make Amaury see reason, and if I have to, I'll go to German headquarters myself. He prowls the woods at night in complete breach of the rules with a weapon. He's had it. She rushed into the bedroom, woke Amaury up, and told him what had happened. So this is what it's come to, she concluded. They can come and challenge me, steal from me, insult me in my own home. Well, let them. Do you think the insults of a farmer are going to affect me? But he's a dangerous man. He'll stop at nothing. I'm sure that if I hadn't had the presence of mind to keep quiet, if I'd called for the Germans who were passing by on the road, he would have been capable of attacking them, or even... She let out a little cry and went deathly pale. He had a knife. I saw the light reflected off the blade, I'm sure of it. Can you imagine what might have happened? A German murdered at night in our grounds? Oh, go and prove you're not involved, Amaury. It's your duty. You must do something. That man bragged about hunting in the grounds all winter, so he must have a gun at home. A gun! Even though the Germans have said over and over again that they won't stand for it. If he's still got one at home, he must definitely be planning something terrible. An attack of some kind. But do you realise what that means? In the next town, a German soldier was killed, and all the important people in the town, the mayor first, were taken as hostages until they found out who had done it. And in a little village 11 kilometres from there, a young boy of 16 got drunk and threw a punch at a guard who was trying to arrest him for being out after curfew. The boy was shot. But there's worse. Nothing would have happened if he'd obeyed the rules, but they considered the mayor responsible for his constituents, and he was almost executed as well. A pocket knife, Amaury grumbled, but she wasn't listening. I'm beginning to think, he said, getting dressed, his hand shaking. It was nearly 8 o'clock. I'm beginning to think I shouldn't have agreed to be mayor. You're going to make a formal complaint to the police station, I hope. At the police station, you're mad. We'll have the whole place against us. You know that to these people, taking what we've refused to sell them doesn't count as stealing. They see it as a joke. They'd make our life miserable. No, I'll go to German headquarters right now. I'll ask them to keep the matter quiet, which they will certainly do, for they're discreet and they'll understand the situation. They'll look around at the Savary's place and will no doubt find a gun.
Are you sure they'll find something? People like that
think they're very clever, but I know where they hide things. They brag about it in the bars after they've had a few drinks. It's either in the loft, the cellar, or the pigsty. They'll arrest that Benoit, but I'll make the Germans promise not to punish him too severely. He'll get away with a few months in prison. We'll be rid of him for a while, and afterwards, I bet you anything, he'll watch his step. The Germans know how to bring people into line.
What's wrong with them?
Exclaimed the Viscount, who was now half-dressed, his shirt-tails flapping round his bare thighs.
What kind of people are they? Why can't they leave well alone? What are they being asked to do? To keep quiet, to leave everyone in peace? But no, they have to grumble, quibble, show off. And just how is that going to get them anywhere, I ask you? We were defeated, weren't we? All we have to do is keep a low profile. You'd think they were doing it on purpose, just to annoy me. I had succeeded, after a great deal of effort, in getting along with the Germans. There's not a single one of them living in the chateau, remember? That was a great favour. And what about the whole region? I'm doing everything I can for it. I'm losing sleep over it. The Germans are behaving politely to everyone. They salute the women. They stroke the children. They pay cash. But no, that's not enough. What else do they want? That they give us back Alsace and Lorraine? That they agree to our becoming a republic with Léon Blum as president? Ha! What do they want? What?
Don't upset yourself, Amaury. Look at me. See how calm I am. Just do your duty without hoping for any reward other than from heaven. Believe me, God can see into our hearts.
I know. But it's hard all the same.
The Viscount sighed bitterly. And without stopping for breakfast, he had such a lump in his throat, he told his wife, that he couldn't have swallowed a crumb. He left, and in the utmost secrecy, requested an audience at German headquarters. Chapter 17. The German army had ordered a requisitioning of horses.
The going price for a mare was in the region of 60,000 or 70,000 francs. The Germans were paying, promising to pay, half that amount. It was nearly harvest time, and the farmers bitterly asked the mayor how they were supposed to manage.
With our bare hands, eh? But we're warning you, if we aren't allowed to work, it's the towns that'll starve to death.
But my good fellows, I can't do anything about it, muttered the mayor. In fact, the farmers knew very well that he was powerless. It was simply that they secretly held a grudge against him.
He'll be all right. He'll get by. He won't touch a single one of his cursed horses.
Nothing was going right. A storm had been raging since the night before. The gardens were soaked with rain. Hail had wreaked havoc in the fields. That morning, when Bruno left the Angeliers' house to ride to the neighbouring town, where the requisitioning was to take place, he looked out over a desolate landscape, lashed by the rainstorm. The great lime trees lining the wide road had been violently battered. They creaked and groaned like masts on a ship. Bruno, however, experienced a feeling of joy as he galloped along. This pure, biting cold air reminded him of eastern Prussia. Oh, when would he again see those plains, that pale green grass, those marshes, the extraordinary beauty of the skies in spring, the late spring of northern countries, those amber skies, pearly clouds, reeds, rushes, sparse clumps of silver birch? When would he again hunt for heron and curlew? Along the way, he came across horses and their riders from all the hamlets, villages and estates in the area heading for town. They're good animals, he thought, but badly cared for. The French, and all civilians actually, understood nothing about horses. He stopped for a moment to let them pass. They were zigzagging by in small groups. Bruno studied the animals closely. He was trying to work out which ones would be suitable for war. Most of them would be sent to Germany to work the fields, but some of them would have to carry heavy loads in the African desert, or the hop fields of Kent. God alone knew where the wind of war would carry them. Bruno remembered how the horses had neighed in terror as Rouen burned. It was raining now. The farmers walked with their heads down, only looking up when they saw this motionless cavalryman with his green cape thrown over his shoulders. For a moment their eyes would meet. They are so slow, Bruno thought. Look how clumsy they are. They'll get there 2 hours late, and when are we supposed to have lunch? We'll have to see to the horses first. Well, go on then, get a move on, he muttered, impatiently hitting the back of his boots with his riding crop, restraining himself so he didn't start shouting out orders as he did during manoeuvres. Some old people walked past him, children, and even women. Everyone from the same village stayed together. Then there would be a gap. Only the swirling wind filled the space, the silence. Taking advantage of one of these lulls, Bruno broke into a gallop and headed for the town, leaving the patient procession behind. The farmers were silent. They had taken all the young men. They had taken the bread, the wheat, the flour and the potatoes. They had taken the petrol and the cars, and now the horses. What would they take tomorrow? Some of them had started out at midnight. They walked with their heads down, stooped over, faces impassive. Even though they told the mayor they'd had enough, that they wouldn't do another thing, they knew very well the work had to be finished, the harvest taken in, they had to eat. Strange to think we used to be so happy, they thought. Germans, bunch of bastards. You have to be fair, though. It's war. Still, for God's sake, how long will it go on? How long? Muttered the farmers as they looked at the stormy sky. Men and horses had passed by Lucille's window all day long. She covered her ears so she wouldn't hear them anymore. She didn't want to know anything anymore. She'd had enough of these warlike scenes, these depressing sights. She was deeply disturbed by them. They broke her heart. They prevented her from being happy. Happy, my God. So there's a war, she said to herself. So there are prisoners, widows, misery, hunger, the occupation. So what? I'm not doing anything wrong. He's a most respectful friend.
The books, the music, our long conversations, our walks in the May woods. What makes them shameful is the idea of the war, this universal evil, but he's no more at fault than I am. It's not our fault. Just leave us in peace. Leave us alone. Sometimes she even frightened and surprised herself at feeling such rebellion in her heart, against her husband, her mother-in-law, public opinion, this spirit of the hive Bruno talked about. That evil, grumbling swarm serving some unknown end, she hated it. Let them go where they want. As for me, I'll do as I please. I want to be free. I'm not asking for superficial freedom, the freedom to travel, to leave this house, even though that would be unimaginably blissful. I'd rather feel free inside, to choose my own path, never to waver, not to follow the swarm. I hate this community spirit they go on and on about. The Germans, the French, the Gaullists, they all agree on one thing. You have to love, think, live with other people as part of a state, a country, a political party. Oh, my God, I don't want to. I'm just a poor, useless woman. I don't know anything, but I want to be free. Slaves, she continued thinking. We're becoming slaves. The war scatters us in all directions, takes away everything we own, snatches the bread from out of our mouths. Let me at least retain the right to decide my own destiny, to laugh at it, defy it, escape it if I can. A slave? Better to be a slave than a dog who thinks he's free as he trots along behind his master. She listened to the sound of men and horses passing by. They don't even realize they're slaves, she said to herself. And I would be just like them, if a sense of pity, solidarity, the spirit of the hive, forced me to refuse to be happy. This friendship between herself and the German, this dark secret, an entire universe hidden in the heart of the hostile house, my God, how sweet it was. Finally, she felt she was a human being, proud and free. She wouldn't allow anyone to intrude into her personal world. No one. It's no one's business. Let everyone else fight each other, hate each other. Even if his father and mine fought in the past, even if he himself took my husband prisoner, an idea that obsessed her unhappy mother-in-law, what difference would it make? We're friends. Friends? She walked through the dim entrance hall and went up to the mirror on the chest of drawers that was framed in black wood. She looked at her dark eyes and trembling lips and smiled. Friends. He loves me, she whispered. She brought her lips to the mirror and gently kissed her reflection. Yes, he loves you. You don't owe anything to the husband who betrayed you, deserted you. But he's a prisoner of war. Your husband is a prisoner of war. And you let a German get close to you, take his place? Well, yes. So what? The one who's gone, the prisoner of war, the husband. I never loved him. I hope he never comes back. I hope he dies. But wait. Think, she continued, leaning her forehead against the mirror. She felt as if she were talking to a part of herself she hadn't known existed until then, who'd been invisible and whom she was seeing now for the first time. A woman with brown eyes, thin, trembling lips, burning cheeks, who was her, but not entirely her. But wait, think. Be logical. Listen to the voice of reason. You're a sensible woman. You're French. Where will all this lead? He's a soldier. He's married. He'll go away. Where will it lead? Will it be anything more than a moment of fleeting happiness? Not even happiness, just pleasure. Do you even know what that is? She was fascinated by her reflection in the mirror. It both pleased her and frightened her. She heard the cook's footsteps in the pantry near the entrance hall. She jumped back in terror and started walking aimlessly through the house. My God, what an enormous, empty house. Her mother-in-law, as she had vowed, no longer left her room. Her meals were taken up to her. But even though she wasn't there, Lucille could still sense her. This house was a reflection of her, the truest part of her being. just as the truest part of Lucille was the slender young woman in love, courageous, happy, in despair, who had just been smiling at herself in the mirror with the black frame. She had disappeared. All that was left of Lucille Angélier was a lifeless ghost, a woman who wandered aimlessly through the rooms, who leaned her face against the windows, who automatically tidied all the useless, ugly objects that decorated the mantelpiece. What a day! The air was heavy, the sky grey. The blossoming lime trees had been battered by gusts of cold wind. A room. A house of my very own, thought Lucille. A perfect room, almost bare. A beautiful lamp. If only I could close these shutters and put on the lights to block out this awful weather. Marthe would ask if I were ill. She'd go and tell my mother-in-law, who would come and open the curtains and turn off the lights because of the cost of electricity. I can't play the piano. It would be seen as an insult to my absent husband. I'd happily go for a walk in the woods in spite of the rain, but everyone would know about it. Lucille Angélier's gone mad, they'd all say. That's enough to have a woman locked up around here. She laughed as she recalled a young girl she'd heard about, whose parents had shut her up in a nursing home because she would slip away and run down to the lake whenever there was a full moon. The lake. The night. The lake beneath this torrential rain. Oh, anywhere far away. Somewhere else. These horses, these men, these poor resigned people hunched over in the rain. She tore herself away from the window. I'm nothing like them, she told herself. Yet she felt bound to them by invisible chains. She went into Bruno's bedroom. Several times she'd slipped quietly into his room in the evening, her heart pounding. He would be propped up on his bed, fully dressed, reading or writing, the metallic blonde of his hair glistening beneath the lamp. On an armchair in the corner of the room would be his heavy belt with the motto, Gott mit uns, engraved on the buckle. A black revolver, his cap and almond green greatcoat. He would take the coat and put it over Lucille's legs, because the nights were cold since the week before with its endless storms. They were alone. They felt they were alone in the great sleeping house. Not a word of their true feelings was spoken. They didn't kiss. There was simply silence. Silence followed by feverish, passionate conversations about their own countries, their families, music, books. They felt a strange happiness, an urgent need to reveal their hearts to each other, the urgency of lovers, which is already a gift, the very first one, the gift of the soul, before the body surrenders. Know me, look at me, this is who I am, this is how I have lived, this is what I have loved, and you? What about you, my darling? But up until now, not a single word of love. What was the point? Words are pointless when your voices falter, when your mouths are trembling amid such long silences. Slowly, gently, Lucille touched the books on the table. The Gothic lettering looked so bizarre, so ugly. The Germans. The Germans. A Frenchman wouldn't have let me leave with no gesture of love other than kissing my hand and the hem of my dress. She smiled, shrugging her shoulder slightly. She knew it was neither shyness nor coldness, but that profound, determined German patience, the patience of a wild animal waiting for its hypnotized prey to let itself be taken. During the war, Bruno had said, we spent a number of nights lying in wait in the Meuvre forest. Waiting is erotic. She had laughed at the word. It seemed less amusing now. What did she do now? But wait. She waited for him. She wandered through these lifeless rooms. Another 2 hours, 3 hours. Then dinner, alone. Then the sound of the key locking her mother-in-law's door. Then Marthe crossing the garden with a lantern to close the gate. Then more waiting, feverish and strange. And finally, the sound of his horse neighing on the road, the clanking of weapons, orders given to the groom who walks away with the horse, the sound of spurs on the doorstep, and the night, The stormy night with its great gusts of wind in the lime trees and the thunder rumbling in the distance. She would tell him. Oh, she was no hypocrite. She would tell him, in clear, simple French, that the prey he so desired was his. And then what? Then what? She murmured. A mischievous, bold, sensual smile suddenly transformed her expression, just as the reflection of a flame illuminating a face can alter it. Lit up by fire, the softest features can look demonic. They can both repel and attract. She walked quietly out of the room. Chapter 18. Someone was knocking at the kitchen door. They knocked shyly, softly. You could hardly hear it through the driving rain. Some kids wanting to get out of the storm, thought the cook. She looked out and saw Madeleine Savary standing on the doorstep, holding a dripping wet umbrella. Martha looked at her for a moment, astonished. People from the farms hardly ever came into the village, except on Sundays for high mass.
"What's going on? Come inside, quickly. Is everything all right at home?"
"No, something terrible's happened," Madeleine whispered. "I need to speak to Madame right away."
"Lord Jesus, something terrible? Do you want to speak to Madame Angelier or Madame Lucille?"
Madeleine hesitated.
"Madame Lucille, but be quiet. I don't want that awful German to know I'm here."
"The officer, he's away at the requisitioning of the horses. Sit down by the fire, you're soaking wet. I'll go and get Madame."
Lucille was alone, finishing her dinner. She had a book open on the tablecloth in front of her.
"Poor dear," Martha said to herself in a moment of sudden lucidity. "Is this the kind of life she should have? No husband for 2 years? And as for Madeleine, what terrible thing could have happened? Something to do with the Germans, that's for sure."
She told Lucille that someone was asking for her.
"Madeleine Savary, madame. Something terrible's happened to her. She doesn't want anyone to see her."
"Show her in here. Is the German, Lieutenant von Falk, home yet?"
"No, madame. I'll hear his horse when he comes back. I'll warn you."
"Yes, good. Go on now." Lucille waited, her heart pounding. Madeleine Savary entered the room, deathly pale and out of breath. The modesty and caution innate to country folk battled against her emotional turmoil. She shook Lucille's hand, mumbled, I'm not disturbing you, am I? And how are you?" as was the custom, then said, very quietly, making a terrible effort to hold back her tears, because you just didn't cry in front of anyone unless it was at someone's deathbed. The rest of the time you had to control yourself, to hide your pain, and indeed your pleasure, from others.
"Oh, Madame Lucille, what should I do? I've come to ask your advice because we're finished. The Germans came to arrest Benoit this morning."
"But why?"
Lucille exclaimed.
"They said it was because he had a hunting rifle hidden away. Like everyone else, as you can imagine. But they didn't search anywhere else. Just our place. Benoit said, go ahead and look. They did look, and they found it. It was hidden in the hay in the cowshed. Our German, the one living with us, the interpreter, he was in the room when the men from headquarters came by with the gun and ordered my husband to go with them. Wait a minute, Benoit said. That isn't my gun. It must be someone who lives round here who hid it so they could denounce me. Give it to me and I'll prove it to you. He was talking so naturally that the men weren't suspicious. My Benoit takes the gun, pretends to be examining it, and suddenly... Oh, Madame Lucille, the two bullets fired almost at the same time. One killed Bonnet, and the other Booby, the big Alsatian that was with him."
"I see," murmured Lucille. "I see. Then he jumps out the window and runs off, the Germans right behind.
But he knows the place better than them, as you can imagine. They haven't found him yet. The storm was so bad they couldn't see two steps in front of them, thank goodness. Bonnet's laid out on my bed where they put him. If they find Benoit, they'll shoot him. He might have been shot for hiding a gun, but if that was all he'd done, we could have hoped he'd get off. Now we know what to expect, don't we?"
"But why did he kill Bonnet?"
"He must be the one who denounced him, Madame Lucille. He lives with us. He could have found the gun. These Germans, they're all traitors, and that one was chasing after me, you see, and my husband knew it. Maybe he wanted to punish him. Maybe he said to himself, might as well, then he won't be able to play up to my wife when I'm not around. Well, maybe I... And he really hated them, Madame Lucille. He was longing to kill one of them.
They've been looking for him all day long, you say. You're absolutely sure they haven't found him yet?
I'm sure,
said Madeleine after a moment's silence. Have you seen him?
Yes. This is life or death, Madame Lucille. You won't say a word.
Oh, Madeleine. All right, then.
He's hiding at Louise's place, our neighbour whose husband is a prisoner of war.
They're going to turn the village upside down. They're going to look everywhere.
Thank goodness they were requisitioning the horses today. All the officers are away. The soldiers are waiting for orders. Tomorrow they'll start the search. But, Madame Lucille, farms have plenty of hiding places. They've had escape prisoners right there under their noses plenty of times. Louise will hide him good, but it's just... Well, it's her kids. The kids play with the Germans. They aren't afraid of them, and they talk. They're too little to understand. I know the chance I'm taking, Louise told me. I'm doing it willingly for your husband, just like you would do it for mine. But nonetheless, it would be better to find another house where he could hide until he can get away from here. They'll be watching all the roads now, won't they? But the Germans won't be here forever. What we need is a big house where there aren't any children.
Here?
Lucille said, staring at her.
Here, yes. I thought... You do know that a German officer lives here.
But they're everywhere. But the officer hardly ever comes out his room, does he? And I've heard... Forgive me, Madame Lucille. I've heard he's in love with you and that you can do whatever you like.
Oh, I'm not offending you, am I?
They're men like the rest, I know, and they get bored. So if you said to him, I don't want your soldiers upsetting everything in the house, it's ridiculous. You know very well I'm not hiding anyone. First of all, I'd be too scared to... Things that women can say, and in this house that's so big, so empty, it will be easy to find a hiding place, some little corner, and then there's a chance he'd be saved, the only chance.
You might say that if you get caught, you risk going to prison, perhaps even being killed. With these brutes, it's possible, but if we French don't help each other, who will? Louise, she has kids, she does, and she wasn't scared. You're all alone.
I'm not afraid. Lucille said slowly. She thought about it. The danger for Benoit would be the same whether he was in her house or anywhere else. What about the danger for her? What's my life worth anyway? She thought with unintentional despair. Really, it had no importance. She suddenly thought of those days in June 1940, 2 years, only 2 years ago. Then, too, amid the chaos, the danger, she hadn't thought about herself. She had let herself be carried along by a fast-flowing river. "There's my mother-in-law," she murmured. "But she doesn't leave her room anymore. She wouldn't see anything. And there's Marthe. Oh, Marthe's family, madame. She's my husband's cousin. There's no danger there. We trust her family. But where could he hide?" I was thinking maybe the blue bedroom near the attic, the old playroom that has a kind of alcove. But then, my poor Madeleine, you mustn't have any illusions. If fate is against us, they'll find him here as well as anywhere, but if it's God's will, he'll escape. After all, German soldiers have been killed in France before, and they've not always found the ones who did it. We must do everything we can to hide him, and just hope, don't you think?
Yes, madame. Hope,
said Madeleine, and the tears she could no longer hold back flowed slowly down her cheeks. Lucille put her arms round Madeleine and hugged her.
Go and get him. Go through the May woods.
It's still raining. No one will be out.
Listen to me. Trust no one, German or French. I'll wait for you at the little garden door. I'll go and warn Marthe.
Thank you, madame,
Madeleine stammered.
Go quickly. Hurry.
Madeleine opened the door without making a sound and slipped out into the deserted, wet garden where tears seemed to drip from the trees. An hour later, Lucille led Benoit in through the little green door that opened onto the May woods. The storm was over, but an angry wind continued to rage. Chapter 19. From her room, Madame Angélier could hear the local policeman shouting in front of the municipal hall,
"Public announcement by order of German headquarters."
Worried faces appeared at all the windows. What is it now? Everyone thought with fear and hatred. Their fear of the Germans was so great that even when German headquarters ordered the local police to instruct the villagers to destroy rats or have their children vaccinated, they wouldn't relax until long after the final drum roll had ceased, and they'd ask the educated people in the village, the pharmacist, the notary or the police chief, to repeat what had just been announced.
Is that all? Are you sure that's all? They're not taking anything else away from us.
They gradually calmed down.
Oh, good. They said, good, that's fine then. But I wonder why it's their business.
This would have made everything all right if they hadn't added,
they're our rats and our children. What right have they got to destroy our rats and vaccinate our children? What's it to them?
The Germans present in the square took it upon themselves to explain the orders.
We must have everyone in good health now, French and German.
The villagers quickly conceded, with an air of feigned submission.
Oh, they smile like slaves, thought the elder Madame Angelier. Of course, good idea. It's in everybody's best interest. We understand.
And each one of them then went home, threw the rat poison in the fire, and hurried to the doctor to ask him not to vaccinate their child because he was just getting over the mumps, or he wasn't strong enough because they didn't have enough food. Others said straight out, we'd rather there were one or two sick kids. Maybe it'll get rid of the fritz. Alone in the square, the Germans looked around them benevolently and thought that little by little the ice was breaking between conquered and conqueror. On this particular day, however, none of the Germans were smiling or talking to the local people. They stood very straight, a hard stare on their pale faces. The policeman had just played a final drum roll. He was a rather handsome man from the Midi, always happy to be surrounded by women. He was obviously enjoying the importance of what he was about to say. He put his drumsticks under his arm, and with the grace and skill of a magician, he began to read. His attractive, rich, masculine voice echoed in the silence.
A member of the German army has been murdered. An officer of the Wehrmacht was killed in a cowardly way by one Benoît Savary, residing in the district of Bussy. The criminal succeeded in escaping. Any person guilty of providing him with shelter, aid, or protection, or who knows his whereabouts, is required to report this information to German headquarters within 48 hours, or will otherwise incur the same punishment as the murderer. That is, immediate execution by firing squad.
Madame Angelier had opened the window slightly. When the policeman had gone, she leaned out and looked into the village square. People were whispering, in shock. Only the day before they had been discussing the requisitioning of the horses. This new disaster, added to the previous one, led to a sort of disbelief in the slow minds of the country folk.
Benoît! Benoît did that! It isn't possible!
The secret had been well kept. The villagers were largely ignorant of what happened in the countryside, on the large, jealously guarded farms. As for the Germans, well, they were better informed. They now understood what the commotion was about, why there had been whistles in the night, and why, the evening before, they had been forbidden to go out after 8 o'clock.
They must have been moving the body, and they didn't want us to see.
In the cafes, the Germans talked quietly among themselves. They, too, had the impression it was all horrible, unreal. For 3 months they had lived alongside these Frenchmen. They had mixed with them, they had done them no harm, they had even managed, thanks to their consideration and good behaviour, to establish a humane relationship with them. Now, the act of one madman made them doubt everything. Yet it wasn't so much the crime that affected them, as the solidarity, the complicity they could sense all around them. In the end, for a man to elude an entire regiment hot on his heels meant that everyone must be helping him, hiding him, feeding him. Unless, of course, he was hiding in the woods. But the soldiers had spent the entire night searching them. So, if a Frenchman kills me tomorrow, each soldier was thinking, me, they welcome in their house, me, they smile at, who has a place at their dinner table and is allowed to sit their children on my knee. There won't be a single person who'll feel sorry and speak up for me, and everyone will do their best to hide the murderer. These peaceful country folk with their impassive faces, these women who smiled at them, who had chatted to them yesterday, but today walked by embarrassed, avoiding their eye, they were nothing but a group of enemies. They could hardly believe it. They were such nice people. Lacombe, the shoemaker, who had offered a bottle of white wine to the Germans the week before because his daughter had just received her high school diploma and he didn't know how else to express his joy. Georges, the miller, a veteran of the last war, who had said, "Peace as soon as possible and everyone in his own country. That's all we Frenchmen want." The young women, always eager to laugh, to sing, to share a secret kiss. Were they, now and forever, to be enemies? The Frenchmen, meanwhile, were wondering, "That Willie, who asked permission to kiss my kid, saying he had one the same age in Bavaria? That Fritz, who helped me take care of my sick husband? That Evert, who thinks France is such a beautiful country? And that other one I saw standing in front of the portrait of my father, who was killed in 1915. If tomorrow he was given the order, he'd arrest me. He'd kill me with his own hands, without thinking twice." War. Yes, everyone knows what war is like. But occupation is more terrible in a way, because people get used to each other. We tell ourselves they're just like us after all, but they're not at all the same. We're two different species, irreconcilable, enemies forever. Madame Angelier knew them so well, these country people, that she felt she could look at their faces and read their minds. She sniggered. She hadn't been taken in, not her. She hadn't let herself be bought. For everyone in the village of Bussy had a price, just like in the rest of France. The Germans gave money to some of them, the wine merchants who charged soldiers of the Wehrmacht 100 francs for a bottle of Chablis, the farmers who got 5 francs each for their eggs. To others, the young people, the women, they gave pleasure. The villagers were no longer bored since the Germans arrived. Finally, they had someone to talk to. God, even her own daughter-in-law. She half closed her eyes and raised her white, translucent hand to cover her lowered eyelids, as if she were trying not to look at a naked body. Yes, the Germans thought they could buy tolerance and forgetfulness that way. And they had. Bitterly, Madame Angelier made a mental inventory of all the important people in the town. All of them had yielded. All of them had let themselves be seduced. The Montmorts, they entertained the Germans in their own home. She'd heard that the Germans were organizing a celebration in the Viscount's grounds, by the lake. Madame de Montmort told everyone who would listen that she was outraged, that she would close all the windows so she couldn't hear the music or see the sparklers beneath the trees. But when Lieutenant von Falk and Bonnet, the interpreter, had gone to see her about borrowing chairs, bowls and tablecloths, she'd spent nearly 2 hours with them. Madame Angelier had heard this from the cook, who'd heard it from the groundsman. These aristocrats were part foreigners themselves, after all, if you looked closely enough. Wasn't it true that through their veins ran the foreign blood of Bavaria, Prussia, abomination, and the Rhineland? Aristocrats intermarried without a thought for national boundaries. But come to think of it, the upper middle classes weren't much better. People whispered the names of collaborators, and their names were broadcast loudly on English radio every night. The Maltets of Lyon, the Pericans of Paris, the Corbin Bank, and others as well. Madame Angelier came to feel that she was a race apart, staunch, as implacable as a fortress. Alas, it was the only fortress that remained standing in France. But nothing could bring it down, for its bastions were made not of stone, not of flesh, not of blood, but of those most intangible and invincible things in the world, love and hate. She walked quickly and silently up and down the room. "There's no point in closing my eyes," she murmured. "Lucille is ready to fall into the arms of that German." There was nothing she could do about it. Men had weapons. They knew how to fight. All she could do was spy on them, watch them, listen to them, keep her ears open for the sound of footsteps, a sigh in the silence of the night. So that these things at least would be neither forgiven nor forgotten, so that when Gaston got back, she quivered with intense joy. God, how she despised Lucille. When everyone was finally asleep in the house, the old woman did what she called her rounds. Nothing escaped her. She counted the cigarette stubs in the ashtrays that had traces of lipstick on them. She silently picked up a crumpled, perfumed handkerchief, a flower, an open book. She often heard the piano or the German's low, soft voice as he hummed, stressing some musical phrase. The piano. How could anyone like music? Every note seemed to grate on her exposed nerves and made her groan. She preferred the long conversations that she could just about hear by leaning out of the window above the library window they left open on those beautiful summer evenings. She even preferred the silences that fell between them, or Lucille's laughter. Laughter when her husband was a prisoner of war. Shameless hussy, bitch, heathen. Anything was better than music. For music alone can abolish differences of language or culture between two people and evoke something indestructible within them. Madame Angelier sometimes walked up to the German's room. She listened to his breathing, his mild smoker's cough. She crossed the hall where the officer's large green cape hung beneath the stuffed stag's head and slipped some sprigs of heather into his pocket. People said it brought bad luck. She didn't actually believe it herself, but it was worth a try. For a few days now, two to be exact, the atmosphere in the house had seemed even more ominous. The piano was silent. Madame Angelier had heard Lucille and the cook whispering to each other for a long time. Is she now betraying me as well? The church bells began to ring. Ah, the funeral of the murdered officer. There were the armed soldiers, the casket, the wreaths of red flowers. The church had been requisitioned. No Frenchman was allowed in. They could hear a choir of excellent voices singing a religious hymn. It was coming from the chapel of the Virgin. That winter, the children had broken a pane of glass during catechism class and it hadn't been replaced. The hymn rose up through this ancient little window set above the altar of the Virgin and obscured by the great branches of the lime tree in the village square. How happily the birds were singing! Now and again their shrill voices almost drowned out the German hymn. Madame Angelier didn't know the name or age of the dead man. All German headquarters had said was an officer of the Wehrmacht. That was enough. He must have been young. They were all young. Well, it's all over for you now. What can you do? That's war. His mother will eventually understand that, Madame Angelier murmured, nervously fiddling with her black necklace. It was made of jet and ebony, and she'd started wearing it when her husband had died. She sat, motionless, until evening, as if riveted to the spot, watching everyone who crossed the street. In the evening, not a single sound. I haven't heard even the faintest creak from the third step, thought Madame Angelier, the one I hear when Lucille leaves her room and goes out into the garden. The silent, oiled doors are her accomplices, but that faithful old step speaks to me. No, there's not a sound. Are they together already? Maybe they're meeting later. The night passed. Madame Angelier was overcome with burning curiosity. She slipped out of her bedroom and placed her ear against the officer's door. Nothing. Not a single sound. If she hadn't heard a man's voice somewhere in the house earlier that evening, she might have thought he hadn't come back yet. But nothing got past her. Any man in the house who wasn't her son was an insult to her. There was a smell of foreign tobacco. She went pale and raised her hands to her forehead like a woman who thinks she's about to faint. Where is he, the German? Closer than usual, since the smoke is coming in through the open window. Is he going through the house? Perhaps he's leaving soon and knows it, so he's choosing the furniture he'll take, his share of the spoils. Didn't the Prussians steal their grandfather clocks in 1870? Today's soldiers won't have changed that much. She imagined his sacrilegious hands rifling through the attic, the larder, and the wine cellar. Thinking about it, it was the wine cellar that worried Madame Angelier most. She never drank wine. She recalled having had a sip of champagne for Gaston's first communion and at her wedding, But wine was somehow part of their heritage, and as such was sacred, like everything destined to continue after we die. That Chateau d'Yquem, that... She had been given those wines by her husband to pass on to her son. They had buried the best bottles in the sand, but that German, who could tell? Instructed by Lucille, perhaps. Let's go and see. Here's the wine cellar, with its door and iron locks like a fortress. Here's the hiding place only she knows about, by a cross marked on the wall. No, everything seems in order here as well. Nevertheless, Madame Angelier's heart is pounding furiously. It is clear that Lucille has just been down to the cellar. Her perfume lingers in the air. Following its scent, Madame Angelier goes back upstairs, through the kitchen, the dining room, and finally, on the staircase, comes face to face with Lucille carrying a plate, a glass, and an empty wine bottle. So that's why she went down into the wine cellar and the larder, where Madame Angelier had thought she heard footsteps. A romantic little supper, said Madame Angelier in a voice as low and stinging as a whip. I beg you, please be quiet. If you knew, and with a German. Under my own roof, in your husband's house, you miserable. Be quiet, won't you? Can't you see the German isn't back yet? He'll be here any minute. Let me go and tidy up. In the meantime, you go upstairs, open the door to the old playroom, and see who's in there. Then, after you've seen, meet me in the dining room. I was wrong, very wrong, to act without telling you. I had no right to put your life in danger. You've hidden that farmer here. The one accused of the murder. At that very moment they heard the regiment. There was the hoarse shout of orders being given, and immediately afterwards the sound of the German officer coming up the steps to the house. His walk was unmistakable. No Frenchman could produce that hammering of boots, that rattling of spurs. It was a walk that could only belong to a proud conqueror striding over the enemy's cobblestones, joyfully trampling the defeated land. Madame Angelier opened the door to her own room, pushed Lucille inside, followed her in, and turned the key. She took the plate and glass from Lucille, rinsed them in her dressing-room washstand, carefully dried them, and put away the bottle after checking the label. Table wine? Yes, well done. She's prepared to be shot for hiding a man who killed a German, thought Lucille, but she wouldn't be happy to give him a good bottle of Burgundy. Thank goodness it was dark in the cellar, and I was lucky enough to take a bottle of red wine worth only 3 francs. She remained silent, waiting with intense curiosity to hear what Madame Angelier would say. She couldn't have kept the presence of a stranger hidden from her much longer. This old woman could see through walls. Finally, Madame Angelier spoke. "Did you think I would hand that man over to the Germans?" she asked. Her pinched nostrils were trembling. Her eyes sparkled. She seemed happy, elated, almost mad, like a former actress who is once again playing the role she starred in long ago and whose nuances and gestures are second nature to her. Has he been here long?
3 days.
Why didn't you say anything to me?
Lucille didn't reply.
You're mad to have hidden him in the blue room. He should stay in here. Since all my meals are brought to me upstairs, there is no risk of anyone challenging you. You have your excuse. He can sleep on the sofa in the dressing room.
Think about it, Mother. If he's found in our house, the risk is terrible. I can take all the blame, say that you didn't know what I was doing, which is actually the truth, but if he's in your room...
Madame Angelier shrugged her shoulders. Tell me everything, she said, with an eagerness in her voice that Lucille hadn't heard for a long time. Tell me exactly how it all happened. All I know is what the police said. Whom did he kill? Was it just one German? Did he wound any others? Was it at least a high-ranking officer?
She's in her element, thought Lucille. She's so eager to do her duty in the call to arms. Mothers and women in love, both ferocious females. I'm not a mother and I'm not in love. Bruno. No, I mustn't think of Bruno. No, I mustn't. So I can't see things in the same way. I'm more detached, colder, calmer, more civilized. I still believe that. And also... I can't imagine that all three of us are really risking our lives. It seems so melodramatic, so extreme. Yet Bonnette is dead. Killed by a farmer who some would treat as a criminal and others as a hero. And what about me? I have to choose. I have already chosen. In spite of myself. And I thought I was free. You can question Sabari yourself, Mother, she said. I'll bring him to you. Make sure you don't let him smoke. The lieutenant will smell someone else's tobacco in the house. I think that's the only danger. They won't search the house. They would scarcely believe anyone would dare hide him here in the village. They'll raid the farms. But we could be denounced.
Frenchmen don't denounce one another, the old woman said proudly. You've forgotten that, my girl, since you got friendly with the Germans.
Lucille remembered something Lieutenant von Falk had told her in confidence. The very first day we arrived, he'd said, there was a package of anonymous letters waiting for us at headquarters. People were accusing each other of spreading English and Gaullist propaganda, of hoarding supplies, of being spies. If we'd taken them all seriously, everyone in the region would be in prison. I had the whole lot thrown onto the fire. People's lives aren't worth much, and defeat arouses the worst in men. In Germany it was exactly the same.
But Lucille said nothing of this to her mother-in-law and left her to make up the sofa in the dressing room. She looked impassioned, light-hearted, and 20 years younger. Using her own mattress, pillow, and her best sheets, Madame Angélier lovingly prepared a bed for Benoît Sabari. Chapter 20. For a long time, the Germans had been making arrangements for a great celebration at the Château de Montmort. It was to take place on the night of the 21st of June. This was the anniversary of the regiment's arrival in Paris. But no Frenchman was to know this was the reason the date had been chosen. The commanding officers had given orders to respect French national pride. All races are aware of their own faults. They know them better than even the most malevolent foreign observer. In a friendly conversation, a young Frenchman had recently told Bruno von Falk, "We Frenchmen have very short memories. This is both our strength and our weakness. We forgot that after 1918, we were the victors, and that was our downfall. We'll forget after 1940 that we were defeated, which will perhaps be our salvation."
"As a nation, we Germans too have a weakness that is also our greatest quality, our tactlessness, which is really a lack of imagination. We are incapable of putting ourselves in anyone else's place. We hurt people for no reason, we make others hate us, but that allows us to behave inflexibly and without faltering."
Since the Germans mistrusted their tendency to be tactless, they were particularly careful of what they said when speaking to the locals. They were therefore accused of being hypocrites. Even when Lucille asked Bruno, "And what's this celebration in honour of?" he avoided answering honestly. "In Germany, they always had a party around the 24th of June," he said, "as it was the shortest night of the year. However, since the 24th had been set aside for large-scale manoeuvres, they'd brought the date forward." Everything was ready. They were setting up tables in the castle grounds. They'd asked the local people to lend them their best table linen for a few hours. With respect, infinite care, and under the supervision of Bruno himself, the soldiers had made their selection from the piles of damask tablecloths that lay deep inside cupboards. The middle-class ladies, eyes raised to heaven, as if they were expecting to see Sainte Genevieve herself descend from on high, Bruno thought mischievously, to strike down the sacrilegious Germans, guilty of daring to touch this family treasure, made of fine linen, hem-stitched, embroidered with birds and flowers. These ladies stood guard and counted their towels in front of the soldiers.
"I had 4 dozen of them, 48, Lieutenant, and now there are only 47.
"Allow me, Madame, to count them again with you. You're just upset, Madame. I'm sure we haven't lost any. Ah, here's the last one. It fell on the floor. Allow me to pick it up and return it to you, Madame."
"Oh, so it is. I'm sorry, Monsieur," the lady replied with her most sour smile. "It's just that when cupboards are turned out like this, things disappear if you're not careful."
Nevertheless, he'd found a way to cajole them.
"Naturally, we have no right to ask you to lend us these things," he said, saluting solemnly. "You know we are not entitled to them." He even implied that the general shouldn't find out. "He's so strict. He'd tell us off for behaving impertinently.
But we're so bored. We want to have a wonderful party. It's a favour we're asking of you, madame. You are perfectly free to refuse.
Magic words. Even the most sullen face lit up with a hint of a smile, like the pale and dismal light of the winter sun, thought Bruno, shining on one of your opulent, decrepit houses.
But why shouldn't you enjoy yourselves, monsieur? You will take good care of these tablecloths, won't you? They were part of my dowry.
Ah, madame, I give you my word of honour that they will be returned to you intact, washed and ironed.
No, no. Just give them back as they are, thank you. Wash my linen.
But we don't send them to the laundry, monsieur. The maid launders them under my supervision. We use fine ashes.
Then all he had to do was smile sweetly and say, Well, what do you know? So does my mother.
Oh, really? Your mother too? What a coincidence. Perhaps you could use some napkins as well.
Madame, I didn't like to ask. I can let you have 2, 3, 4 dozen. Would you like any cutlery?
The soldiers had come out of the houses, weighed down with clean, scented linen, their pockets full of dessert knives, and holding, as if it were the Holy Sacrament, an antique punch bowl or some empire coffee pot whose handle was decorated with ornamental leaves. Everything was stored in the chateau kitchens until the celebration. The young women laughed and called out to the soldiers,
How are you going to dance with no women?
We'll have no choice, ladies. That's war for you.
The musicians would play from the conservatory. At the entrance to the grounds were pillars and poles decorated with garlands of flowers that would be used to hoist the flags, the regimental flag which had been carried during the campaigns in Poland, Belgium and France and had emerged victorious from 3 capital cities, and the swastika, stained, Lucille whispered, with the blood of Europe. Yes, sadly, all of Europe, Germany included. The noblest, youngest, most fervent blood, which is always the first to be shed in battle. And with whatever blood remained, the world would have to be rebuilt. That is why the aftermath of war is so difficult. Every day, from Chalon-sur-Saône, Moulins, Nevers, Paris and Épernay, military trucks arrived with cases and cases of champagne. If there couldn't be women, there would at least be wine, music and fireworks down by the lake.
We're going to come and watch, the young French women said. Forget the curfew for one night, all right? Since you'll be having fun, you could at least let us have a good time too. We'll take the road down to the chateau and watch you dance.
Laughing, the girls tried on party hats made of silvery lace, masks and paper flowers for their hair. What party had they been meant for? Everything was slightly crumpled, faded, as if it was second-hand, or from some costume wardrobe in Cannes or Deauville, belonging to a nightclub manager who, before September 1939, was counting on future seasons.
"How funny you look in all this!" the women said.
The soldiers strutted about, making funny faces. Champagne, music, dancing, a rush of pleasure— so they could briefly forget the war and how quickly time was passing. The only thing they worried about was the possibility of a storm that night, but the nights were so clear. Then, suddenly, there was this terrible disaster. A comrade murdered unheroically, killed by some drunken, cowardly farmer. They had considered cancelling the celebration. But no, the warrior mentality reigned supreme here. The tacit acceptance that immediately after you had died, your comrades would dispose of your shirts, your boots, and spend the whole night playing cards while you lay in the corner of some tent, if your remains had been found, that is. Yet it was also a mentality that accepted death as something natural, an ordinary soldier's destiny, and therefore refused to sacrifice a moment's pleasure because of it. Besides, the officers' main responsibility was to think of their men, to distract them from demoralizing thoughts about future dangers and how very short life was. No, Bonnet had died without suffering much. He'd been given a beautiful funeral. He would not have wanted his comrades to be disappointed because of him. The celebration would take place as arranged. Bruno gave in to the childish excitement around him. It was mad and slightly desperate. the kind of excitement that a truce brings out in soldiers who see the possibility of a moment's relief from the day-to-day boredom. He didn't want to think about Bonnet, or about what was whispered behind the closed shutters of these grey, cold, enemy houses. Like a child who's been promised to go to the circus and is then told he must stay home because some old, annoying relative is sick, Bruno wanted to say, "But what has that got to do with it? That's your problem. What has it got to do with me?" Did it have anything to do with him, Bruno von Falk? He wasn't just a soldier of the Reich. He wasn't motivated uniquely by what was best for his regiment or his country. He was a sensitive human being. He, like everyone else, was looking for happiness, the unhampered development of his abilities. Yet, like everyone else, sadly, during these times, his justifiable desires were constantly being thwarted by certain national interests called war, public security, the necessity of maintaining the prestige of the victorious army. A bit like the children of princes, whose sole reason for existence is to carry out the wishes of their father, the king. He felt this majesty, the way the greatness and power of Germany reflected on him, as he walked through the streets of Bussy, as he rode through a village on horseback, as his spurs rattled at the doorstep of a French home. But what the French would never understand was that he was neither proud nor arrogant, but sincerely humble, terrified by the magnitude of his task. But he didn't want to think about that, not today. He preferred to enjoy the idea of the ball, or to dream about things he could never have, Lucille by his side, for example. Lucille, who could come with him to the ball. "Ah, it's madness," he said to himself, smiling. "Oh, I don't care. In my soul I am free." He imagined the dress Lucille would wear. Not a modern dress, but the kind you might find in some romantic print. A white dress with layer upon layer of chiffon billowing out like a flower, so that when he danced with her, when he held her in his arms, he could feel the frothy lace brushing against his legs. He went pale and bit his lip. She was so beautiful. Lucille, close to him on a night like this, in the Montmore's grounds with the fanfares playing and fireworks in the distance. Lucille, who, above all, would understand and share the almost religious thrill he felt in his soul, when, standing alone in the dark, he felt the distant presence of a vague and terrible multitude, the regiment, the soldiers, and even further away, the army that fought and suffered, and the victorious army that occupied the cities. "With her," he said to himself, "I would be inspired." He had worked very hard. He used to live in a state of perpetual creative exaltation, mad about music, he would say, laughing. Yes, with her and a little freedom, a little peace, he could have done great things. "Such a shame," he sighed. "Such a shame. One of these days we'll receive orders to leave and we'll be at war again. There will be other people, other countries. Such extreme physical exhaustion that I'll never be able to finish my military career. And the music... still waiting to find expression. Musical phrases, delightful chords, subtle dissonances stand poised, wild winged creatures frightened off by the crash of weapons. It's such a shame." Did Bonnet care about anything besides war? I have no idea. No one can ever truly know another human being. But what if... he, who died at the age of 19, found more fulfillment than me, who's still alive. He stopped in front of the Angeliers' house. He was home. In 3 months he had come to think of all this as his own, the iron door, the prison-like lock, the hall with its musty smell, the garden bathed in moonlight, and the woods in the distance. It was a June evening. Divinely sweet. The roses were in bloom, but even their perfume was overpowered by the smell of hay and strawberries that hovered everywhere since the day before, for it was harvest time. On the road, the lieutenant had come across some wagons full of freshly cut hay, drawn by cattle, as there were no horses left. He had silently admired the slow, regal pace of the cattle pulling their sweet-smelling goods. The farmers looked away as he went past. He had noticed, but he felt happy again and light-hearted. He went into the kitchen and asked for something to eat. The cook served him unusually quickly and without replying to his pleasantries. "Where is Madame?" he said finally. "I'm here," said Lucille. She had come in without making a sound as he was finishing a slice of cured ham on a big piece of fresh bread. He looked up at her. "You're so pale," he said softly, sounding worried. "Pale? Not really, it's just been very hot today." "Where's your good mother?" he asked, smiling. "Let's go for a walk outside. Meet me in the garden." A little later, as he was walking slowly down the wide path between the fruit trees, he saw her. She came towards him, her head lowered. When she was a few steps away, she hesitated. Then, as she always did as soon as they were hidden from sight by the great lime tree, she went up to him and slipped her arm through his. They walked a while in silence. "They've cut the hay in the meadows," she said finally. He closed his eyes, breathed in the aroma. The moon was the colour of honey in a milky sky where wispy clouds drifted by. It was still light out. "It will be nice weather tomorrow for our celebration." "Is it tomorrow? I thought..." She didn't finish what she was saying. "Why not?" he said, frowning. "Nothing. I just thought..." He nervously flicked at the flowers with the riding crop he was holding. "What are people saying?" "About what?" "You know very well about the crime." "I don't know. I haven't seen anyone." "And what about you? What do you think?" "That it's terrible, of course. Terrible and incomprehensible. After all, what have we as people done to them? It's not our fault if we upset them sometimes. We are just following orders. We're soldiers. And I know for a fact that the regiment did everything possible to behave properly, humanely, didn't they?"
"Certainly."
"Naturally, I wouldn't say this to anyone else. Among soldiers, it's understood that we don't show pity towards the comrade who's been killed. That would go against military thinking, which requires that we consider ourselves solely as part of a whole. Soldiers can die just so long as the regiment lives. That's why we're not postponing tomorrow's celebration," he continued. "But I can tell you the truth, Lucille. My heart breaks at the thought of this 19-year-old boy being murdered. He was a very distant relative of mine. Our families know each other. And then there's something else I find stupid and revolting. Why did he have to shoot the dog, our mascot, our poor booby? If ever I find that man, I'd happily kill him with my bare hands."
"I expect that's what he must have been saying to himself for a long time," Lucille said softly. "If I ever got my hands on one of those Germans, or even one of their dogs, how happy I'd be." They looked at each other, dismayed. The words had slipped through their lips almost against their will.
"It's the same old story," said Bruno, forcing himself to sound light-hearted.